Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses...
The reality of that 8-show a week slog is really hard.
When I start on a character, I have to draw them, and I'm not an artist.
This is, in effect, built in myth and mystery. So you'd be sitting in this tiny little bio box with radiators all around you.
Which was a funny thing, because I don't think that play would have happened in that way if it wasn't at Griffin.
You're a bit different to the other girls in this area.
Yes, I thought, yes, I am.
That was the days when they could smell an actor or a singer and think, oh, I've got 6 weeks.
My sisters really taught me that I had to be versatile.
This ostrich, pink ostrich feather sticking up out of my hair, out of this wig.
My first career, as it were, was preparation for my second career.
And her face was beaming. It was just beaming at me.
I hadn't lost any of my passion or love for it, so it's been a joy to talk to you. Thank you very much.
New York-born Natalie Moskow appeared on Australian stages over a 3-decade period in productions that included The Rocky Horror Show, Get Happy, The Conquest of Carmen Miranda, Company, and Oscar's Turn to Sing. Her earliest theatrical experiences were garnered as a dancer in a string of operas for the Metropolitan Opera House, as well as Swan Lake and Sleeping Beauty for Britain's Royal Ballet. She turned to acting in 1965 with plays for Off-Broadway's American Place Theatre. In 1968, she was a member and later starred with the original Broadway cast of Hair and began a 4-year association with that show, which took her as a performer-choreographer to Toronto, Boston, Paris, and finally Melbourne for the beginning of the Australian tour. Following Hair, Natalie toured with Jesus Christ Superstar, leaving that show for major roles in Grease, Two Gentlemen of Verona, No Sex Please, We're British, Pippin, Gershwin, and The Magic Show. An offer to recreate her Australian role in The Magic Show on Broadway took her back to America, where she has worked on Broadway television and regional theatres since. Natalie performed the role of ballerina Grushinskaya in the West End production of Grand Hotel, and for the prestigious Paper Mill Playhouse in New Jersey, Belinda Blair in Noises Off, and Emily Whitman in the first revival of Stephen Sondheim's Follies, alongside Kay Ballard, Eddie Bracken, Donna McKechnie, and Anne Miller. And there is so much more to be explored in her extensive career on and off the stage in this riveting episode of the Stages podcast. Natalie Moskow, hello. It's lovely to have you on Stages.
Oh, thank you. It's lovely to be here. I'm thrilled to be back in Australia, sort of.
Sort of, yeah, absolutely, via the interweb. Natalie, you were a name that was quite prominent on Australian stages for about 3 decades, but in the last 20 years, we probably haven't heard that much of you because you've been residing in New York. Your original visit to Australia came through the musical Hair, didn't it?
Yes, it did. I came out to choreograph the Sydney production, or re-choreograph it, for Melbourne's opening. They wanted it much more glitzy, so they changed the set and they got Brian Thompson and Jimmy Sharman came back, but for a much bigger production, and they brought me out. I was supposed to be, I don't know, some kind of Broadway influence.
It's a long way to travel for a gig.
Well, I like travel. And I figured if they were paying, it's probably the best way to get anywhere is someone else footing the bill, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. It makes sense, doesn't it?
Certainly does. I hadn't realized that it was quite that arduous a journey. It takes about 2 weeks to recover. So I thought, well, I'd better stay until I feel better. And I did.
And you stayed and stayed.
I did.
So what was that impetus for staying in Australia? Did more career
opportunities
open
up? Here's the inside story. So initially, David Taguri came down to choreograph Melbourne. This is dirt. I'm giving you dirt. And he decided, because David was originally Canadian, he was living in London, but he had relatives in Japan because he's Japanese descent. He's gone now. And he came down to direct, and he said, well, why don't you do all the choreography and I'll go to Japan and visit my relatives and then I'll come back and handle the scenes. So I was working like a dog and all the dances were really tight and really fabulous. And he got Harry Miller, the producer, came to see the show and he said, well, the scenes are a mess, but the dances are great. So I don't need David Taguri. I'll get Jimmy to come in. So this goes on. Jimmy comes in, and I had choreographed the same dances for Jimmy in Boston, where that's how we'd met. Previous to doing Australia, I'd met Jim through Boston Hair, where I was hired to choreograph that production. And Jim decided he thought it was too regimented and he didn't like the dances. But you see, I couldn't get into the country. I didn't have any kind of anything except a visa to come in, but not a visa to stay, a visa to work, whatever. I don't know what they did, but Sandy McKenzie, who came and brought us all, the African-Americans and me, on the plane, said, why don't you sign a contract to perform? Now, my normal fee was about $3,000, $4,000. And after they changed all the dances, Freddie Gibson, who was the associate producer with Harry, said, we'll give you $50 a dance. Here's $200 or $300, something like that. And I said, I have a contract to perform. I'm staying till I make my fee. Pure willfulness on my part. But that's really what happened.
Brilliant, brilliant. The beginning of a wonderful adventure.
I think possibly, open mouth change feet, sort of just jumping into things for one reason and getting another result. It's, I hope I jump somewhere soon. I'm getting very bored the way things are going here.
Of course, you'd had experience with Hair in New York.
I'd done the original Broadway production.
Yeah.
And I was in the show and they didn't know I could dance when I got in. And they were kind of pleased and appalled at the same time because they thought they were going to get this rough and tumble crowd. And I actually danced with the Royal Ballet before the Hair. So they thought, well, let's put it to good use anyway. And they made me dance captain. And when I got bored doing the show and they wanted to find somebody new to do Toronto because they weren't happy with the team that was creating a Toronto version of Hair, they fired the director choreographer and hired Jim and Jerry, the writers, to direct and me to come up and choreograph. So my first big choreographic gig was doing Toronto Hair, which we did in record time. And it was tremendous fun and I had the best time. And, you know, I went and did a commercial. I want to say it's for the Super Bowl, and it was Pepsi, I think. And I'm up into, and they had me flying. I was in a harness. One of the boys in Hair, one of the African Americans in New York, was Joe Morton, and he's a well-known African American actor. But it was the Joe Morton harness, and they wanted me to do lifts in this commercial, and they weren't sure the man who was lifting me could do it, so they had me in this harness. And I'm hanging there, and they all go to lunch, and I'm in this harness. But later, I started screaming, and they said, "Who? Okay, we'll take you down. But it turned out, when I mentioned that I'd choreographed Hair in Toronto, they were like, oh, my God, are you aware that's the first production that was all Canadian actors? We didn't import anyone. So it was a big deal. And it was like when I was talking to Michael Caton when he came to New York, and we had done Two Gentlemen of Verona together later after we'd done Hair in Melbourne. And I'd had one of the roles, one of the leading roles in, and he'd had another one, Speed, I think the character was, and he had a dog in it. And he said to me, are you aware that's the first show in Australia I've actually been able to use my Australian accent?
Wow.
Because he'd done a lot of musicals and like doing Hair, that's an American accent, no, or you're doing a British show and you're always doing. And so it never even occurred to me how liberating that must have felt.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, you don't know that you're making differences in people's lives and you find out like 30, 40 years later.
Were you involved with the musical when it premiered at the Public?
Not at all. No, I didn't know anything about it. And in fact, when we went to audition, I remember thinking, well, I'm going for an audition called Hair. What kind of a show is called Hair? I mean, what does that mean? Ugh, no one knew.
Choreographing the piece and working with performers who weren't necessarily trained, I believe, for the authenticity of the tribe. They garnered a lot of people who hadn't really had any showbiz experience. Did that prove to be frustrating at times when you had to move those people around the stage that didn't really have showbiz knowledge?
No, not at all, because the whole situation, well, first of all, I think we had as many professionals in the Australian production as we had non-professionals. And also in New York, a lot of the people who were in the show had done other work or had trained or had done the public. So they were familiar with it. But the essence of the dances, at least in New York, and those are the ones that I tried to bring, or like when I went to Paris, I did the same thing. I did improvs with the cast dancing to pick up what they could do and adapt their moves to make the steps theirs, and they owned them, and therefore they had more power in them. And that's what we did originally in New York. We would have Steve Gillette, our lead guitarist, would jam in rehearsals, and we'd all just dance. And Julie Arenal, the choreographer, would say, okay, everybody stop. We're going to do this step. This is the Natalie Mosco step. Or we'd do another step, and she says, everybody stop. Everybody try this. This is the Marjorie Lipari step. And they got incorporated into the show that way. So in a way, it wasn't so much imposing outside movement on the people, but extending the movement we brought. So that's kind of, it was diamond in the rough time. So the original producer and the original writers were very attracted to the idea of using theater as a political influence. And it was the time of the Vietnam War. And you'll remember, of course, that the only people conscripted to go fight there were the Americans and the Australians. So it was a particularly simpatico union for that show to be with Australia. But the producers and the writers decided the best way to, as Sheila would say, spread the groovy revolution, which was basically anti-war and pro-love, was to have as many different productions happening around the country and around the world as possible simultaneously to effect real change.
Yeah, and it certainly did make it its presence felt, didn't it, as political theatre.
It was an outgrowth of the original director, Tom O'Horgan, not the off-Broadway director, because they had originally wanted Tom O'Horgan to do the public directing, but he was busy with a tour of La Mama in Europe, and he also was taking Futz to Europe and everything like that. So they got another director, Gerald Friedman, who the scuttlebutt, the story again, is that Anna Sokolow, the choreographer, I think Gerald Friedman had a little bit of a turn of some kind, an emotional turn, definitely. And he just did a meltdown from what I understand, and Anna Sokolow picked up. So when we went to Broadway, they reapproached Tom O'Horgan, and he brought the ideas from La Mama and the exercises of Grotowski and the Living Theater and the La Mama troop exercises and the whole idea of making it a political theater. That's where, you know, America Hurrah, Jean-Claude Van Italie came out of, and a lot of those other things that were trying to effect change through theater, political change.
Can you enlighten me about the iconic nude scene? I believe that wasn't an original part of the show. It came in later.
Well, it wasn't in the public. It wasn't when they did it at the Cheetah Discotheque, and it wasn't in our contracts when we signed to do rehearsals. And somewhere around the middle of the second week of rehearsal, they said, we've always wanted to do this. At one of the B-ins, everybody took their clothes off and burned their draft cards. And we all went, no, absolutely not. We're not doing that. No, 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 never, never, never. So one by one, that wheedly little person, Tom O'Horgan, you know, he would go to us separately and say, what do you think? We could just use a few people to do this. We know you're not signed to do it, but it could make a real difference. And it really did change a lot of people's minds. And there were, I would say, 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 women and 6 men out of a cast of 21 who agreed to do the nude scene one by one. And then suddenly they did it. And it was so dark and so quick. I mean, I've seen it other places. I couldn't believe how much, first of all, almost everybody's doing it. When I got to Australia, almost everybody was doing it. The lights were bright. The lights were up forever. I was like, okay, this is nude beach. It was just like, Very different from New York. Very different.
but bizarrely, I mean, it's one of those iconic moments in musical theatre, like Shall We Dance in The King and I, or Dolly's arrival at Harmonia Gardens. It's something that people look forward to, and not necessarily because of the voyeuristic perspective of it, but just because it's just one of those moments we associate with that show.
Well, yes, and they weren't foolish. They knew it would sell tickets.
Yeah, absolutely.
In fact, people got very disgusted, and there's a lot of the people who had been doing the nude scene chose not to do it. So they decided to offer everybody $1.50 or $1.75 to do it. And, well, you know, I had at one point decided to try it, you know, and when I heard the price, I said, I'm worth more than that. I'm never doing it again. I just want to finish about the nude scene. One of the things that was very, very interesting was that you always knew when the nude scene was coming up, because all the stagehands were in black, right? But all the stagehands from the other shows would come to our theater too, and you'd look stage right, prompt, in our theater was where a prompt was, stage right, and you'd see all these white socks in the wings, because they were in blacks except for the white socks. Was hysterical. Every stagehand on Broadway that could get out was there to see our nude scene.
This is around the same time as O Calcutta, I imagine.
Yeah, but O Calcutta was tacky. I mean, it kind of saw the money that Hare made and they thought, let's go with it. I mean, it was kind of. I haven't seen it, but they kept us, every time we did publicity, we were linked with O Calcutta. That was my first radio interview was with the O Calcutta team. I didn't feel comfortable with that. I much preferred working with the Your Own Thing team, which was kind of a rock musical, or sometimes we'd do something with the Olivia Hussey and the Zeffirelli Romeo and Juliet kids and
Leonard Whiting.
Yeah, Leonard Whiting. Yes, Leonard Whiting. Exactly. Leonard Whiting. And it was kind of like the young icons of the time. And we were the young icons. I mean, I didn't even know it. And one day I was walking down the street and somebody said, you know, you look like that girl from Hair. And I went, oh, I am that girl from Hair.
Yes, O Calcutta was more gratuitous, whereas the nude scene in Hair had a political point. It was a statement. Yeah.
Right. I think they thought that the ballet, the new ballet, was supposed to make an aesthetic point. I think I think ballet is probably a better choice than tap dancing, say, for a nude.
Didn't Robert Helpman say that sort of about nude dancing? It's a concern because once the dance stops, there's just a part of that appendage that continues to move.
Ever perceptive, our Sir Robert.
Indeed. Now, your stay in here in Australia, you finish up, obviously decide to stay. You need to find an agent, I guess, to continue pursuing work.
Well, actually, I was getting a lot of work in Melbourne just simply from being in here. I got billboard right away. One of our people in our show was friends with Oscar Whitbread at the ABC, and he came to see me and they wrote me a part in billboard. It was a twin. I was a mad twin. Ha 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 ha. And I came to wreak vengeance, which, you know, there I was in number 96, another mad. Well, I wasn't a twin, but I was a double identity. What can I say? There must be something about Americans and craziness.
Or you do the femme fatale very, very well.
I do. I don't know. I think they write it and I play it. I don't know.
you played Rizzo in Greece. Again for Harry M.
Yes, I did. That was an interesting experience. That was before we did. That was a fantastic cast, by the way. I don't know if you had time to research it, but I will tell you who was in that cast. And I always leave someone out because they're all so fabulous. John McTiernan was playing my boyfriend. You don't know Marianne Chin now, but she did the national tour as Petra in Night Music in America with Gene Simmons, and she was our Sandy. Tina Bursell, Chris McQuaid, Denise Drysdale, Pamela
Gibbons,
Garrick. Pamela
Sorry.
Garrick, David Atkins, John Diedrich, Ron Chaloner. I'm leaving people out. Sal Shirah, please forgive me. Robin Mose was one of the understudies. So was Robin Gardner, one of the, was it Robin Gardner or the other one? They were agents, and one was, it's a long time ago.
I think you've done pretty impressively with that list.
Oh, no, they were terrific. And it was Ross Coleman choreographing. Patrick Flynn was musical director. And Jonathan Banks from Better Call Saul was our director, because he was down as stage director for Hair. And he was directing us. Well, in the very beginning, he took the boys out to do some kind of group work to learn what it felt like to be in a gang. And he promptly broke one of the, they were on motorbikes, and one of them broke their arm. So right away, the understudy had to come in. And Sal Shira was one of the understudies, so he had to take over one part. Then, I mean, he told me before I started rehearsals, he says, I want you off book before day one. Oh, I'll tell you who else was in it. Gary Down was in it. Gary Down was playing one of the older people, the elders. I mean, there was just an extraordinary cast. And Denise was hysterical. She was playing Cha-Cha de Gregorio with those breasts. But we got this because the movie hadn't come out yet. Nobody thought much of it. And I'll tell you that story, too. That was a really good story. I was miserable sometimes. So anyway, the review came out, and somebody said, well, we don't really relate to this kind of 50s, early 60s kind of people. We had Bodgies and Widgies. They're very different. And the National, was it the National or the Nation? There was a newspaper that was very right-wing and harsh and a bit anti-women, as everything was pre-73 and probably still is to some extent. They came out and they said the best thing in the production was Denise Drysdale's breasts and my ass.
Oh,
arse, no. They said, yeah. Arse. Because I was in big white pedal pushers anyway. No. But now what was it? Oh, yes. So we did some publicity, and they decided they were going to bring Johnny O'Keefe in. And I didn't know who he was, and I was feeling a bit snotty. So I put on the blonde wig that they had put aside for Tina Bursell to wear. And I went down there, and I was dancing with him in my blonde wig and being horrible. I mean, just dreadful. I don't know. I guess we were being kind of Bolsheviki. Just, oh, these are adults, and we're the kids, and the whole text of the show. Are we allowed to say F words? Are we allowed to swear on your podcast?
Absolutely. It's a podcast. You
okay,
go
well,
for
so
it.
the whole undercurrent, there's a photo of us that I actually sent to Equity to use, and they used it at the back issue, and it's all of us giving the finger. Everybody that I mentioned in the cast. And that's the photo. And the whole text of Hair, well, probably Hair too, but Grease was fuck you.
Fantastic.
Yeah, really, it really was. It's just, I remember that lovely man who was our musical director, who then went into Air Supply, and his name is gone now, and I know he died from AIDS, which was horrible, and he was a lovely, lovely man. And he had taped the whole show, and we had a party at his house like 6 months after the show closed, and he played it, and I was like, oh my God, we said that on stage? That's horrible. That's just, I mean, I remember, hi, kids, look who's here. It's little Patty Simcox, the little Lulu of, whoa, I don't know, whatever the high school was. Rydell High, what does she want? Maybe she's having a period, wants to be alone, I would say. I mean, like, like that. I mean, Jesus. And then I got to do Shakespeare after that, which was much more cultured. It was Two Gentlemen of Verona.
There are worse things you can do.
Oh, well, that was a great. So I had a really great part, but everybody was wonderful. Yeah. Everybody was just wonderful in that cast. And I mean, Robin Mose was another understudy. It's just, you know, a lot of them went on to have big careers and still have big careers.
Yeah.
Just, you know, terrific.
I was fascinated
and
to
they're
see
still friends. They're still friends, you know, the ones that I keep in touch with, we're still friends. I just the other day, I called John Diedrich. I think he's retired now somewhere in Western Australia with, I want to say, olives. But we had a long talk about everything.
Yeah, I'm talking to John in a few weeks, so he'll be an episode.
Give him my
up.
Love.
I will
give
indeed.
Give him my best.
Yeah, and he's residing in Victoria, down in Melbourne.
Ah, okay, yeah. He promised to send me olive oil for Christmas, but I thought, you don't know my address, and you're not allowed to do that. You can't send things through the mails. But I said thank you.
I was fascinated to see that you know, your next show, Two Gentlemen of Verona, and also The Magic Show, were done in Australia. Were they successful seasons?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, they were terrific shows, both of them. And they both got great reviews. The problem with Two Gentlemen of Verona was we opened the same night that Jesus Christ Superstar opened. Is it the Palais? I think it was at the Palais. The rock opera Tommy opened. The rock opera Tommy opened. And all the producers were approached by the newspapers to say, would you change your opening date? And they all dug in their heels and refused. And I had this story. I had this, you know, John Guare, playwright, wrote the book to Two Gentlemen of Verona, adapting the Shakespeare. And we had I'm a member of this company, the Workshop Company, that used to give out awards annually, and we chose John Guare. And I was sitting with him at this gala that we gave, and I said, you know, I've got to tell you what really happened. The producers all refused to change their opening night. So the first string critics went to, the rock critics went to Tommy, and the theater critics went to Jesus Christ Superstar. And we got the third string, which were probably just the straight theater critics who didn't like musicals anyway. So we all opened the same night, but we didn't get the thunder. The show did very well. It did close early. We were supposed to go to Adelaide next. Magic Show was a whole other story, though, because Magic Show, we were scheduled. We did a great season at the the Princess. We kept looking for the ghost. We did a great season at the Princess, and we were supposed to then transfer to Sydney to open the new MLC Centre Theatre, that one. There was a strike, so we couldn't get in there because the theatre wasn't done. So Ken Brodziak of Aztec Productions scrambled like crazy, who was the producer of the show, to get us up to Tokyo to do the show in Japan, but it fell through, and so we had to let the show go, and we never got the momentum again. And then soon after that, I decided to go back to New York.
Yeah, there are so many influences that can impact the resonance of a show, isn't there?
I think the thing that's so unusual, I mean, it's sort of like when you talk about something like hair, it just had to be the right confluence at the right time, at the right place. I wrote a play with, a musical tribute with Frank Garfield called Get Happy. And we had some wonderful music. And I'm not changing the subject. We had wonderful musical directors. We had David King. We had Michael Tyack. We had Alan McFadden. We had a cast of three, which was me and Robin Arthur and Frank Garfield. But at the very end of the play, and it's about Harold Arlen, the composer who wrote Wizard of Oz the whole bunch of songs for the Cotton Club and things like that. And at the very end, after we sing the Wizard of Oz, I believe he said something like, we all three of us split up the dialogue, and he said, hit tunes, well, you know, you don't know, you write what you write, something along those lines, and then you give it over and you don't know where it's going to go. And he said, you have to be so goddamn lucky. And that's really what it's about with anything, whether it's a song or a show or any creative project. There's that element of luck, of being just in the right place at the right time and doing the right thing that catches the public. It's just strange and wonderful. Rather than go right back to New York after the Magic Show, I was approached by John Diedrich and John O'May, and we got Carolyn Gilmore on board, and we did a show called Gershwin. And Gershwin was 31 full songs or pieces of songs by George and Ira Gershwin. And we got the rights to the songs, and we did the show, and we got great reviews, and we got to try. And I went to New York for a little visit and came back. I didn't go for a visit. That's another time. That's 73. No, this was 75, 76. And I think I did. And then I came back with someone else. Yeah, Barbara Ramsey and Peter Noble took over for John O'May and me because we went home for Christmas briefly. That is true. But we came back. I came back in 76, and I was going to do the show. And we did the show. And then we got this wonderful letter from Ira Gershwin's attorneys. Basically, give us $100,000 or close the show. So Caroline and I go over to John Diedrich. Didn't you get the rights? What's going on? He said, I got the rights. Well, it turned out we called the show Gershwin. And we hadn't realized they'd copywritten their name. So we got all the rights to everything. If we'd known, we could have called it Swanderful and it would have been fabulous, or By George, or anything. And we all looked at each other and I said, well, I've got $125. What have you got? So we had to close the show. And then I thought, well, what am I going to do? And I thought, and then before that, I think it was Roberta was auditioning or being cast. No, they weren't auditioning. They were just making offers. And one of the reasons I left Australia after this was simply, I was up for two parts in Roberta. Johnny Farnham was going to be doing the male lead. And, you know, he wanted to work with me. But there were other people up for the parts as well. And one was Abigail and the other was Jackie Weaver. So I lost one part to Abigail and one to Jackie Weaver. And I said, I don't think these people really know what to do with me. You know, it's kind of like, that's so wide a spread, those two.
Yeah.
That I better go home and just, you know, see what's going on. I was just lucky that I got back and somebody had just gotten a TV series and wanted to get out of their contract with the Magic Show. So within 1 week of auditioning, I made my Broadway return in the part that I had done in Australia with totally different choreography and a totally different cast, but nonetheless, the same songs. It was trying, but it was a wonderful way to come back to Broadway.
Did you do the big number, West End Avenue?
No, that was my friend Dale Souls. She created it, in fact. No, I got It's a Nightmare Being a Dream Come True and Sweet Revenge, which was the big dance number. And which I think that preceded. No, I think we were after West End Avenue. West End Avenue was the big number. That was the really big number.
Yes, yeah, so that's the one that all the girls do at auditions.
Guess what? Now, here's a bit more tales from the crypt. Dale told me they tried to get rid of the song before opening night.
It's such a magnificent song.
Want to know why?
Why? Do tell, okay. Do tell.
The wife of the director was doing my role, her role. I was doing her role. But she was doing a role and he wanted her to have a Tony nomination. And he was afraid that if Dale sang West End Avenue, they would cancel each other out. Dale got on the phone to Stephen Schwartz right away, the composer, and said, are you aware this is happening? And he wasn't, and he vetoed it immediately, and the song stayed in. But it shows you what could happen and how you could lose something wonderful like that.
Oh, yes, the machinations of the theatre.
Or something. I mean, I guess it's the politics. When you look at politics today, you have to look at call whatever's going on the politics.
You were sawn in half in The Magic Show.
Oi. Did you hear the real story? I mean, you know I was really sawn in half.
Yeah, yes, I have heard that. So if you don't mind, would you elaborate on what happened?
Okay. So, yes. I mean, I couldn't believe it. At the risk of Ross Skiffington never talking to me again, I have to tell you how that trick is done. So it's a box that's in two pieces and you get into the box lying horizontally and then you take your legs and you put them up near your left shoulder and make sure they get out of the way. And that's fine, except they also wanted to have the sound effects of something being sawed in half. So they had a piece of wood at either end of the box, either side, so that when the big 6-foot tree saw goes through the box, saws. It has a nice sound of wood being sawed. Well, this day, they lock the box and I go to lift my knees and the piece of wood that had been standing against the edge vertically had fallen sideways and I couldn't get my knee past. So here's my knee hitting against a piece of wood and knowing that they're going to come at me with a tree saw. And of course, we had this lovely boy, Larry, who was acting. He was presenting a huzzah, presto to the whole theater, and he was not looking at me. And I'm going, Larry, Larry, no. Larry. Larry, stop. Larry is acting. Larry is still acting. Now, normally I talk a lot during this, make up jokes, laughing, ha 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 ha, that tickles. Ah. Finally, I went, Larry, stop. And because they'd lifted the saw. And I first thought when I heard the wood sawing, oh, they see the piece of wood and they're going to try and get it out of the way. They didn't see the piece of wood. For some miraculous moment, when Larry stopped, he looked, he realized something was wrong. I managed to pull my knee free and get it up to the shoulder and come down. And God bless him, Ross Shakespeare was one of our ASMs, I think. He's assistant stage manager on this. And I'm on stage. We're doing, from that period where we had the saw and a half, I have jokes. I have a quintet. I have a slow take with my head all by myself on stage. And I kept thinking, they know this has happened. They're going to get me off stage. Nobody knew that I had actually been cut. And I didn't know what was cut. Was my whole leg cut? Was an artery cut? I had no way of knowing. And show must go on. I mean, I was lousy. I was terrible because I, you know, your comic timing's a little off when you're thinking, have I just lost a leg? It was a really horrible experience. So they pull my top half off because they took the other half off without me. And Ross, poor old Ross Shakespeare, he says, okay, come on. I said, I'm bleeding to death. Get me out of here. He thought I was joking.
Oh, no.
He opened the box. All this blood comes gushing out. And he goes, oh, my God, you are. So, you know, we got to the dressing room. I changed my tights. We taped it up. They called a doctor, but there's no interval. My understudy has not been rehearsed. They don't have understudy costumes yet. This is the first week of the run, pretty much early on anyway. And there's no interval to even bring somebody on. So I finished the show and Tony Bartuccio, God love him, comes backstage to tell me, you danced through all your moments in that big dance number. You missed all your beats. And he comes in to give me the notes and there's the doctor stitching up my leg. And he goes, oh, well, I guess that's why. So that's the story. And I was very low-key about it. Somebody told me the whole of Australia in the business was holding their breath thinking I was going to sue the pants off everybody. And, you know, but seriously, it wasn't intentional. I didn't lose my leg. I had a little scar. So give me a little money for the scar because now when I shoot things, I have to shoot from the other side and I might lose a job. But you know, Ken Brodziak called me KB, and I said, oh, Ken, and no one ever called him Ken. It was always KB. I said, oh, Ken, don't worry about it. It's nobody's fault. You know, because things happen. Why was I a fool? I could have had a beautiful house. I had a beautiful house later, but you know what I'm saying. No, you just don't do things like that. I guess they think that's an American thing to be very litigious, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's just not my thing. It's not my thing.
Well, what a very traumatic experience. But thankfully nowadays, with WH&S and all the risk assessment and safety controls, hopefully things like that are avoided.
Yeah, tell the cast of Spider-Man.
Oh, yeah, Spider-Man the musical.
But I've got to tell you, when the very next day I was getting into the box. Oh, no, before the show, Ross Shakespeare and I went and got me in the box again. Because I wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to get the jitters. And I was fine. So then we went on. And
back
my poor understudy never back on the horse, exactly. And the other traumatic thing that happened with both in New York, we had a cougar in New York and we had a lion, Squeaky. Squeaky was our lion in Melbourne. And I got on great with Squeaky. We took photos together, you know. He kind of liked me. I liked him. One day, though, Squeaky refused to go on stage. Turned out he had a tooth abscess and he was miserable. We had an understudy lion, Kimba. And one of the things they're told is do not give the lion anything to drink before the show. Well, the understudy wasn't knowing he was going on, so he was drinking up a storm. Water, of course. So I go to do the change the beautiful magician's assistant, dream girl, me, into the lion, or in New York, the cougar. And I do the trick and I get in and I feel my foot skid. And I find that I'm lying in liquid. And I'm going, what is this? What is this? Sure enough, the lion is revealed. The curtain calls come. I can't come out because I'm reeking of lion's piss. I'm dripping. And it happened in New York, too. And it was worse because I was wearing a red wig in New York because we all were trying to look like a Anita Morris. They had all these red hair jokes. She was the original actor in it. So not only was my whole outfit wet, but my wig was wet, too, which is like, you know, I don't think it's better to have your hair wet. You can at least wash it. The thing I never knew, though, up until I found out, I mean, I was always worried that little dogs would sniff me on the street and smell it and lift their leg just because they I couldn't get the smell of it out. You know, it's just...
I love it. I love it. Well, Natalie, from the crypt, yes. With all this talk of cougars and lions, it's a beautiful segue into my next question. I've got a line of dialogue here for you. The okay. circus is coming. The circus is coming. The circus. What does that line mean to you?
Actually, it was longer than that. It was actually longer than that. I only gave you the most interesting part. When I was, I would say 10, maybe 11, I was selected with one other girl and one little boy to be in La Pericole at the Metropolitan Opera House. I was with the Metropolitan Opera Ballet School, and they took us. We'd been doing operas. I'd done Cavalleria, Lohengrin. I'd done something with Joan Sutherland, and I cannot remember what it is because God knows. We did Falstaff with Zeffirelli and Bernstein was conducting. But they threw my characters out, thank God, because they wanted the fat chorus to jump over us as we rolled like logs on the stage. I mean, it would have been a disaster. We would have all been crushed by very heavy people. So anyway, they picked us to do La Pericole. And by the way, it was opening on New Year's Eve at the old Metropolitan Opera House. It was directed by my first Australian, Cyril Richard. I was, of course, terrified because he was Captain Hook. But he was very sweet. We had live llamas on stage and things like that. And it was Anna Moffo and Theatre Upman doing the, and it was in English, so that was fun. And our entrance was, mommy, daddy, the circus is here, the circus is here, the circus, the circus, the circus. And despite their excellent acoustics, admit, we kept being told that we weren't loud enough. So we screamed our brains out. We're kids, you know, you can't be heard. And it's five tiers up. It was a huge theater. But that was the first line I ever said on stage.
Can you tell me more about Cyril Richard? Because he's a fascinating character, an Australian who had quite a career in New York.
He had quite a career all over the world, really. I mean, he's just, I didn't, well, you know, what's he going to do with the 11-year-old? Hello. No, but he was charming. He was always, and he was directing. He had a lead role in the opera as well. It was like he could do anything. And he was witty, and he was funny, and he had a style. The next time I'd seen him after that was in War of the Grease Paint with Anthony Newley. And they were playing Little Chap and Sir. Not Little Chap, it was another name. Little Chap was Stop the World, but it was Sir and whatever the other character was. Now, where are you, Tony Sheldon, when I need you?
Exactly. I saw Sheldon play that role at Goodspeed.
I bet you did. I bet you did. I heard that was a... Well, I'm not going to malign it, but to hear him tell it, he said it was quite unusual.
It was unusual indeed. Cocky.
Cocky. Cocky and Sir. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you. Now I feel better.
But Cyril Richard, unfortunately, he's not celebrated as enough as he should be in Australia. I don't think people are aware of his career.
They may not be aware that he's Australian.
Mm, exactly.
You know, it's sort of like Coral Brown in a way. Most of their successes were overseas.
What a treat it is to visit these seminal musical theatre shows through the eyes of someone who was there. Join us next time for part two of the Stages Conversation with Natalie Mosco. Natalie recounts growing up and embracing an education in the performing arts and revisits celebrated performances in Follies as Emily Whitman and Grand Hotel as the ballerina Drushinskaya. Throughout her stellar career, she has also worked alongside key artists, teachers, performers, and creatives. Everyone a contributor to Natalie's remarkable story and for who she continues to carry the torch of their combined artistry. We look forward to your company then. I'm Peter Ayers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.